Hi, I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, and host of The Brett Johnson Show. Today's episode, guess what? We've got Devin James that's coming in to pay us a visit. We're going to talk about Web3, because who is he? Well, he is the man behind the Web3 working group. Devin, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, Brett.
No, absolutely. So before we dive into Web 3.0, who is Devin James?
Ooh, Devin James. had a handful of semi-careers leading up to here.
Okay.
I was a Marine infantry veteran. I was in the invasion of Iraq, and you know, that was a whole little weird ball of wax and everything.
Well, mad respect and thank you for your service on that, truly.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. But then otherwise, people are often surprised to hear that I was in the infantry in the Marine Corps, because every other part of my life has been nerdery tech. From the very beginning, when I was 16, I got a job at a dial-up ISP doing telephone support. Okay. For like grandmas trying to get on the internet in the late 90s, when you know ISPs were trying to compete with AOL. And since then, I did like post-production in Hollywood, stuff like that, and a little bit of entrepreneurial type stuff, selling stuff over the internet and stuff like that. Okay. And then eventually in 2013, 2014, that led me into the kind of Web3 space. It was long before it was called Web3. I just discovered kind of Bitcoin and blockchain, and
all right,
that kind of blew my mind, and we went from there.
And I got you've ran through a whole lot of stuff that I got to ask some questions on.
Certainly.
First, how did you end up? So certainly you've laid the groundwork for the nerdery, but how did you end up going into infantry?
Well, okay, so it was in about 2000. I had a boss who was a former Marine, and my life was, you know, a mess. I'm a 20-year-old kind of thing, and he was like, "Boy, that Devin, he just needs to join the Marine Corps and dig ditches." And so he gets a recruiter to call me and talk to me, and I'd had it in my heart, you know, I knew it was something I kind of wanted to do. So just having someone kind of tap me on the shoulder just made it real easy for him. But I had initially, this is before 9/11, you know, time of peace, didn't expect we're going to be going to war with, you know, everyone in the Middle East. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to join the reserves. It's going to pay for college. I'm going to become an officer. I was ultimately supposed to fly planes. And so I thought, if I'm going to be just doing this 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, I might as well blow stuff up. You know, that sounds like fun. And he was, of course, he was an infantry forward observer. And I only found out after the fact, once I was actually in, that that was the job that my grandfather had. Because until you're in, or you have some really close friends in, you don't really understand the distinction between different jobs in the military and stuff. And when I had to decide that, I learned about it. And then after I get in, I find out, oh my God, my grandfather was the exact same thing. He was an air forward observer. Right. So it's a weird little, you know, echo in history kind of a thing.
Right.
So I joined to become a forward observer for an 81 millimeter mortar infantry company, and then went to Iraq with that unit, and then switched units after that to light armored reconnaissance, and became a scout team leader and a wow, forward observer, like the forward observer trainer for the battalion.
I mean, geez, I mean that's doing it. Honestly,
blast of a job. It was a fun job. Obviously, that we got activated right after 9/11, and just did horrendously hard training, and just, right. I mean, you know, it's fun when you're a 21-year-old, you know, and so, if it ain't raining, you ain't training kind of stuff. So it was motivating and it was fun and everything. And then
once a Marine, always a Marine. Front.
Yes, sir. Yes, there sir. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like, yeah. I said, hey,
it's a core
mad
component
respect, truly mad thank respect.
You, thank
so
you.
That answered. You also said post-production Hollywood.
Yes, sir.
All right.
So that, I'd say, came really from, I became a Star Wars nerd after high school. I don't know why, but I decided I really wanted to go become an actor in Hollywood. Oh, that's, senior class play, I was the lead. And
okay.
I enjoyed the heck out of that. I'd never done any acting before that. I was the lead, and I was like big headed and thought, well, I could go become a star in Hollywood. And I find out that George Lucas wants to make this prequel trilogy, and I'm going to be just the right age to play Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader, in the second two movies. I'm like, I will do this. And so me and some friends of mine made a Star Wars fan film to try to get his attention. We'd seen the movie Troops, and we'd heard that Kevin Rubio, the guy that made that, got pulled into Lucasfilm to talk to them and stuff like that. And we're like, we can do this. We can do this. Right. So we had access to some great digital video cameras and some great post-production hardware, and had a lot of fun. Spent years and years working on it. Ultimately didn't even, well, the movie kind of leaked out, but we never released it. But we like released trailers to hype people and stuff like that. The visual effects look great. And really we had to teach ourselves how to do that. And so that taught me like how much fun that was. And I've just always enjoyed Photoshop and all that kind of stuff. And so I became a shake compositor and a 3D visual effects artist. I worked at the Jim Henson Company. That was definitely an absolute blast. They're a fantastic, fantastic place.
Dude, I mean, you're making me so jealous. I mean, you truly are.
It was fun. It was really, really, really fun. But honestly, I got out of it just at the right time. In about 2008, 2009, 2010, the industry was very much kind of falling. The post-production industry was very much leaving LA because the internet was fast enough. The rest of, you know, the kind of third world, India was getting on the internet and getting access to computers and getting really fast and really good at this stuff. And so we saw a lot of our work offshoring more and more and more. And I remember 6 months or so after I left the last gig I was at was when, remember the movie The Life of Pi won the Academy Award
for great Best book Visual too.
Effects. It was a great movie.
Yeah.
While they were up there accepting the award for Best Visual Effects Oscar, their post-production people were outside picketing because they'd like not been paid for 6 months, and then the company went under. And so it was a bit of a disaster. It didn't really, you know, work out for a lot of people, and I'm really glad I got out when I did. Right. But it also kind of helped inform, it led into the thinking that helped me understand why some aspects of Web3 were going to be a lot more revolutionary than a lot of other people were seeing them as, just because it opened up things, some of the constraints that Hollywood deals with right now.
And that's I like the segue. I do, because you know I'm liable to stay on these topics all day. So that being said, let's talk about Web 3.0 first.
Sure.
For those who may not know, since you're the nonprofit Web 3.0 working group, let's explain what Web 3.0 is.
So what is it? So, I mean, we were having some debate when we were first forming it, what should we call it? Because the intent behind Web3 was supposed to really describe a better version of the web that we interact with, the technology that we interact with itself, not necessarily the money involved. Bitcoin started this whole thing, absolutely. And the industry, I've been in it for coming up on 10 years now. It's about a 15-year-old industry, and it's had a hard time really identifying what it is. Is it the cryptocurrency industry? Is it the blockchain industry? Right. Now it's going with the term Web3. It's a number of different things, I would say. When you have a big enough technology, it's like, what is the computer? What do you call the computer industry? Well, it's post-production, and it's cybercrime, and it's you know, there's a whole bunch of different things. It's not just one thing, because there's an overlapping component, and that's the same thing here. So what we were really trying to do when we were giving it the term Web3, and I think the term got away from us, a lot of people really describe it as the entire cryptocurrency industry. A lot of Ethereumers describe it as everything built on top of Ethereum specifically.
Of course, right.
Our intent was to describe it as kind of the infrastructure that the things we do on the internet is built on top of. Say the video transcoding that is being used to host this call, so that, you know, we can both get a good quality a video signal on either side at a relatively low bit rate. The storage of, you know, everything that the files are served on, everything else like that. Those kind of pieces of infrastructure currently are completely centralized.
Okay.
And generally that's worked. You know, it's what was necessary in order to scale the internet from 1 billion users to 5 billion users. That's pretty good. But by doing so the way that we did, we basically built it on the backs of, say, 5 companies, maybe 10 if you're being generous. And they have way too much power that they don't necessarily abuse intentionally. They sometimes abuse intentionally, almost undeniably. Most of the time they abuse unintentionally, just because they think something is a certain way. And here's a good example. A lot of people get deplatformed off of YouTube. You can kind of think of it as sharecropping. You're spending a lot of energy, you're building this whole kind of environment, and you're doing all this work into it, but you don't have complete control over that thing. And so a lot of the times that someone gets deplatformed, it's for really crummy reasons, you know,
right?
Alex Jones saying something relatively hateful, you know, that kind of stuff. But there's much better examples of that, where it's really going the wrong direction with the intent. The intent behind YouTube's policies against, say, violence is to not, videos about violence, is to not encourage other people to be violent. The LAPD put up a video of someone getting beaten in a pretty violent way.
Right.
Their purpose, not to glamorize it, but to literally say, hey, Bolo, you know, can you let us know if you identify any of these suspects? YouTube deplatformed them. YouTube said this violates our policy, and they kicked them off. I think they eventually, you know, got them back on, but they weren't able to put the video back up. And this is law enforcement trying to do law enforcement. So right. There's a lot of different reasons why something might go over a gray line, like a violence policy or something else like that, that are completely legitimate. But the company in control will interpret it however they choose to. So the intent behind, I would say, Web3 and what we're really calling now DPIN, which stands for decentralized physical infrastructure networks, is to move all of that kind of infrastructure tech from proprietary things run by individual companies that generally have monopolies into open protocols so that everyone can participate in how they run, in how they're governed, in actually the revenue generated by being a part of them. For example, like if you've got a PlayStation on your shelf that you haven't used very often, it could be generating you money because the GPUs in it could be contributing to someone else's project and it could be earning you some money, some extra storage space in your computer, et cetera, that kind of a thing. So the term DPIN is really kind of grown up around that. We really like that because it describes very specifically this kind of subset of the cryptocurrency industry where it depends very much on there being a token involved. Because right. In order for the mechanism to work for you to store a file on a network or to transcode a video, you need to pay for it in native tokens so that the work is done at the protocol level and not by people deciding things involved and stuff like that. But just because there's a token involved doesn't mean it's a monetary instrument or that it's a financial product or that it's a security for that matter, which is, you know, what a lot of other certain government agencies are interpreting everything as. So it's a subset of Web3. Web3 kind of broadly is just everything you can do with permissionless decentralized technology. And so far, most of that attention has, of course, gone to DeFi and NFTs right. and, of course, Bitcoin. Bitcoin being, I think, 60% of the value in the entire industry, and rightly so. It's the earliest. It's, you know, the 800-pound gorilla. It's kind of incredible. I think a whole lot of people in this industry still don't totally grok how brilliant proof of work is for what it accomplishes.
Right.
So hopefully that satisfies the question of what is Web3.
I like it. So that being said, would you say that Web 3.0 requires a type of blockchain to be present in whatever the technology is that we're talking about or not?
Not all aspects of it. There's a whole lot of it that does. Like, okay, here's an example. The reason that we got into this, and here's that was my kind of segue, was why the knowledge that I had learned from post-production, and not just the kind of studio-based, but also I'd worked on a couple of indies where I got points for things, and I, you know, earned such and such points for doing various different shots and stuff like that, and then the movie came out and it was sold, and I had no transparency over how many copies were being sold, and thus I had no idea whether I should be earning any money back. And of course, I never saw any money back, and I just had to just assume that everything was on the up and up. And so when I first, so I spent about a year aware of Bitcoin and just thinking this is really cool, and you know, it's great for, it's going to disrupt the banks, because I was just certain the banks are all evil and everything. And then I had an opportunity to pitch some people, and I decided, you know, I'm going to read the white paper myself. I just learned about it by like watching videos and stuff like that. And I finally decided to read the white paper myself, and it blew my mind. And specifically, it opened my mind up to the opportunity to all that a blockchain is a permanent ledger that can't be altered. The Bitcoin blockchain, only for the sake of just, you know, saving block space, the only thing it stores is debits and credits. Like, you know, I sent you X amount, and so now your balance goes up, mine goes down. You could store other stuff. You could store arbitrary pieces of information. And if you store the right arbitrary piece of information, you could create a media distribution network. Right. So the very first thing I kind of did in the industry was kind of share this idea for something called the Decentralized Library of Alexandria, where it uses, you're familiar with the BitTorrent network, right? So BitTorrent network, for the most, the way that most people, especially people that are like downloading movies and stuff like that, will use it is they'll use like a web-based index where it's got a link to a particular, to a file on the network. And that link itself is rather centralized, but there's a version of these things that is uncentralized called a magnet link. Right. And that magnet link doesn't depend on any website, any URL, any kind of a central host. It's just a cryptographic key to identify the file within the hash table itself within the network. So what I did was I had the thought that if I took a file that I wanted to distribute, an independent movie that I wanted to sell over the internet, I could put it into the BitTorrent network, and now it's identified with this magnet link, and I could put that identifier as well as some other information about it, metadata like its title, its description, The year it came out, who I am, and what its commercial terms are. Like, you can watch the first 10 minutes for free, and then you have to pay 50 cents to watch it, or you have to pay $5 if you want to own it, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And put all that into a permanent blockchain. So those are two completely different types of decentralized networks, where on BitTorrent, there's no center. There's nothing that can be censored or controlled as a result of that, but there's also no history to it. And it's not necessarily searchable using metadata. You could search for that specific magnet link, but I can't search with metadata, right? Whereas on the blockchain, it's a point by point history of every single thing that ever went into it. And you can know with certainty nothing was changed and nothing was removed from it. And so to do a lot of different beneficial things with Web3, you kind of need both of those, okay, where you can have the scaling aspect of a fully decentralized network like BitTorrent, which eventually evolved. Now we've got something called IPFS, which is kind of BitTorrent, but better. But in order for IPFS to do anything where you could count on a file that you put in IPFS being there, they had to build Filecoin, which was an actual blockchain that just kind of was a network to exchange. I want you to store these blocks of data, this file in IPFS, and in exchange for giving me proof that you've done it, I'll pay you in these tokens called Filecoin. So I would say the vast majority of the real beneficial uses of Web3, you do need a blockchain involved, and as a side effect, you need a token, because really the token is just, it's the financial incentive for the decentralized group of workers that are contributing to the security of that blockchain and making sure that it's keeping going, for them to get paid in exchange for the work that they're doing.
Okay, so you, and I'm interested in that. You must have a token or not?
I would say you do. I can't think of any good example, because okay, if you're probably aware of Folding at Home and SETI at Home from like the late 90s, early aughts kind of thing.
Especially are, SETI.
SETI, I'm right? They're exactly, me too. They're early examples of decentralized networks that did really big things, and they worked really well. They did really great, important things. You know, Folding at Home, trying to solve proteins folding in order to literally like cure cancer, really important, significant things like that. And then SETI at Home kind of saying like, there's a whole lot of noise coming in. Is any of it signal? And if any of it is signal, then maybe there's others out there, and there's more life in the universe. These are both really important things, and yet within, they're both, I think, 10 years older than Bitcoin. And within 5 years of Bitcoin's existence, its pure compute was something like 100-fold more powerful than SETI at Home. And so it just proves that you're going to get some amount of benefit from something if it has kind of universal benefit that people kind of like and they just want to contribute to, and they want to just, like in that case, it was something where most commonly it was running as someone's screensaver. So if their computer is idle, it'd be able to use some of those cycles. But if you want someone to build a business around it, if you want someone to really scale that up and put a lot of effort into it, they're going to have costs, and they're going to need to have those costs recouped. And so Bitcoin's security to scale and for us to have, you know, mining facilities all over the world that are contributing to this process meant you needed to feed a lot of sunk cost into it, and you need to feed a lot of electricity into it. And the only reason anyone's going to do that is if there's a financial reward in exchange for the work that they're doing. Sure. So I wouldn't say there's too many examples out there where just, you know, wanting to benefit the world is going to be a strong enough incentive to do something of real consequence. There, you need to at least get paid back for the costs, and you're going to invite a whole lot more contribution if there's a chance of people getting wealthy involved. It turns out that the kind of the capitalist system, whatever negative side effects there might be, and certainly there's some really distorted versions of our capitalist system that we can kind of look at. But for the most part, capitalism or free markets does incentivize things to build and get better. And I'd say that's exactly what
I would agree.
Proof that you get from tokens involved in cryptocurrency.
Okay. So that means, okay, so we define pretty much what it is as best as we can. Why should normal people, you know, the everyday non-techie that's out there that, you know, they visit Amazon, YouTube, maybe their dating site or what have you, why should that person really care about 3.0 compared to what they view as a working internet right now?
As a working internet, exactly. Well, when we were just talking about DeFi and NFTs and just investing in kind of the financialization of the internet and stuff like that, I would say for the most part, they wouldn't. They really wouldn't. It's really this new emergent aspect that I was describing called DePIN where they would. Part of that is There's a stat out there. I'm not 100% sure that it's still accurate, but if it isn't, it's close to that. Take all of the unused computer space on all of personal computers out there, and it makes up more storage space than all of the data centers combined, right? And those data centers, when you put a whole bunch of computers tightly together, they overheat, they compound each other's heating. And thus, you put a lot more energy into cooling a data center than you would that same amount of storage distributed around the world. And most people already have their computer turned on in the first place. So just looking at just storage, you can solve a whole bunch of different things by decentralizing that. Everyone that has a computer can earn a little bit of income by lending that out to the internet. So that's one benefit. Okay. The overall energy used, energy involved, and the amount of hardware built in the first place can be much more efficiently used. But also, monopolies aren't good no matter what. Like they tend to be beneficial to scaling, you know, when just one company has to decide, like YouTube controls video right now. So when you're deciding where you're going to put your podcast out, you know, it's like when we were building some, the very first job we were doing entrepreneurially is we were making accessories for iPads. And there was no real thought involved in where you do that. You make it in China. After some time, you think about it, and we ultimately realized, yeah, we don't really like that. You know, we want to see if we can kind of onshore that kind of work and whatnot. Sure. But it's a default thought, because that's the monopoly. Likewise with online video, this is the only one. Likewise with video conferencing, Zoom pretty much has the monopoly. And so there's a whole bunch of negative side effects to monopolies in the first place, like we were talking about at the beginning, that whether it's intentional or otherwise, with the LAPD thing, for example. But also, it also just limits like what the options of monetization are. The assumption from YouTube is that every audience is the same and it's audience size that matters, but the type of users that are watching your show are not exactly the same type of users that are watching every other show. I would imagine a much larger portion of your audience was running ad blockers than most other audiences, right? And so YouTube might assume that they're the exact same value as every other audience, but to YouTube, they were probably less because they were getting less ad revenue. But at the same time, they were more privacy minded. So they also probably would have been perfectly happy if they had a mode where they could watch your show without YouTube spying on them and knowing who they were and what they were, if they could just pay you a dollar to watch your show.
Right.
So different audiences have different needs. And so one big monopoly can meet maybe the middle 50% pretty well, but you need a lot of diversity of options in order to meet everyone's needs. And that's why the web developed the way it did. You know, like before the web, we had AOL. What were the two competitors? It's really funny. You can barely
wasn't Netscape.
No, Netscape was the beginning of the web, was really what started to break it. I can't even remember it. Anyway, obviously that kind of proves the point that, right. But there was a time in the late 90s when these were the internet. They were it. And they were all these self-contained kind of thing, right? Where if you're on one of them and I'm on another, when we can't directly communicate, they started adding email so that we had some method of communication, but we didn't have the ability to chat with each other. And if I was looking at like a stocks thing within my AOL, CompuServe is another one, and you were looking right. at one on CompuServe, they might have a slightly different timing feed, so you're getting different data and stuff like that. So it wasn't one universal internet, it was a couple of individual ones, right? Or different kind of on-ramps to different things. The web, because it was an open protocol that you could build literally anything on, was much more powerful. Even though it wasn't nearly as shiny at the very beginning, its potential was significantly higher. And so, yeah, the early days of the web grew pretty fast, few million people over the first decade or so, but now we're at 5 billion or so on what I think 10 billion websites last I heard or something like right. that. Like it's grown insanely fast, and that's because of the amount of, like, if the website that lured me and made me have the aha moment going, oh my god, the internet is the greatest thing ever, worked for me, it wouldn't necessarily work for you. It might need to be just a different color scheme, or might need to be a completely different a focus, or any number of things. And so if you're going to meet a whole lot of users' needs, you need to have a whole lot of different approaches to doing so. And the way the web is built right now on so few companies, it's too easy for them to force monopolies to exist on each of the different kind of verticals built on top of it. So there's one provider of video and one provider of this and one provider of that. So I'd say the biggest benefit is it opens up the ability to have imagine if instead, if the storage was on a protocol and the video transcoding was on a protocol, and then various different payment options were available on a variety of different kind of means and stuff like that. And so then you put up your content, not uploading to YouTube, but you upload it to the internet and attach to it all the descriptive information that you'd normally put in your YouTube descriptions. And you also put terms on it saying, if you watch for ads, you can watch it for free. If you don't want to watch any ads and don't want to be spied on, you can watch it for 10 or 15 cents. If you want to own a whole season of it, you spend 10 bucks a year and you get whatever. You get to describe your own terms. And then you allow any number of 100 different possible front ends that are all able to, you know, unlimited, but let's just say, to host it and can decide for themselves, do they want to promote yours? And that's because you're also saying to them, if you do, if you are that front end that captures a user to watch my content, you're entitled to 15% of it.
So now you
actually have a full on free market of content around the internet.
All right. And hey, I'm down with that. I get it. I get it. I do. I don't like that really video is only YouTube, and it is for all intents and purposes. It is. Yeah. All right. I don't like that basically, as you said, 10 companies rule the internet. They will determine what you listen to, what becomes popular, everything else like that. So I get this entire decentralized idea. My question becomes, because you were talking about, you know, you could upload this show to the internet. Mm-hmm. How does that person then go about finding this show? It would still mean that there would have to be some sort of aggregator type site, like, you know, if you're doing torrents, Pirate Bay or Kickass Torrents or something like that. Right. But wouldn't that site at that point become that centralized site that would kind of determine
who's I would argue no, because you add that extra little layer of that last point that I was making of, if you find a user for my show that enjoys my show, you get yourself 10 or 15%, but you're not giving exclusivity to anyone. You're saying the data itself is available to any site that wants to push it out. And so if one of them says, we're going to promote this, we're going to make this the top featured show, they're likely to capture a lot more. If someone just says, I know analytically that this show is, that a lot of people that watch this other show would enjoy this show, they can make that connection for themselves. Right now, you're dependent on one algorithm, and that algorithm does a very good job for the most part, but there's no competition.
I agree.
How do we know whether or not, you know, if Spotify applied their algorithm to video, if it could work better? If Apple applied their algorithm to video, their suggestion algorithm, it could work better. If OpenAI had an algorithm for suggesting content, that could work better. There's no competition for those small pieces. Like, just think about on the music side. There's Spotify, there's Apple Music.
And
there's
Spotify is killing everyone.
Right, they very much are. But they're competing almost exclusively. Well, for a while, this might not be true as much anymore, but they were competing almost exclusively by who they had exclusive access to at the very top. And them and Apple Music would compete for those top 10 artists. It was Kanye versus Taylor versus Drake kind of thing. And one of them would lose one, and then suddenly a million users would sway over kind of thing. Right. But they weren't incentivized to compete based upon how good their interface was, how good the experience for their users was. I always felt like Spotify had better suggestion algorithms, but Apple had certain music that Spotify didn't have access to. And I always use that as an example, because what if I want to build a smart playlist around an artist that only Apple has access to? That's pretty limiting to me as a consumer of content that I can't do that. And so what the world I'm talking about is one in which those applications are basically incentivized to solve exactly the problem that you're talking about, the discovery problem, because that's the most important, because there's too much music, too much content, too many people out there. So discovery is the most important thing that the application layer can do. So they can give you the best interface and work behind the scenes on the best lift up mechanisms and discovery mechanisms and suggestion mechanisms, so that, because if they're good at it, they're going to convert more users. And if they convert more users, they get to earn that cut a little bit more than anyone else does. And they're competing on a level playing field, because you're just saying, my terms are my terms. I don't care who you are.
Right.
This is the cost. This is the cut that you get. And if it's worth it to you, try. And if it's not, like, say, for example, you say you're only going to give 15%, but Apple says we require 30%. Well, then Apple's going to exclude you from your stuff. And it's up to you and Apple to kind of decide. If Apple realizes no one's offering more than 20%, they're going to have to lower their threshold. And that's an actual double-sided market that has to, you know, compete for each other's business, rather than this kind of proprietary just extension of the label system where all these deals are kind of made in the back rooms and not really benefiting either the artists or the end user, you know, the consumers of it, just benefiting the platforms itself. I would say the world that I'm describing benefits both the artist and the consumer.
And I, you know, I do agree with that. It's just that thing. When I search for something, if I were into piracy, for example, mm-hmm. I would be going over to, before they shut down a month and a half ago, I'd be going over to rare BG. For the torrents instead of mm-hmm. Instead of Pirate Bay, mm-hmm. And that was where I would spend most of my time. And mm-hmm. Rare would have been very good about delivering 4K content, mm-hmm. about virus free files.
Yeah, they were doing some extra work. Pirate Bay wasn't doing.
Right.
Yeah.
But also, I'm wondering, what if one of these sites has some sort of an ideological type of slant?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, it's not always about money. A lot of the time it is. I mean, 98% mm-hmm. of the time it is. But, you know, we continue to move toward this world where things are becoming more ideologically slanted. So mm-hmm. what happens, and I don't care if we're talking about a pandemic or a political party or what have you, mm-hmm. but what happens when you've got a site that's extremely popular that decides that we are just simply not going to aggregate data mm-hmm. from these users,
from all these ideological? I would say that that exposes their ideology a lot better than the current system does.
I absolutely
agree. As it is right now, it's really easy to, cognitive dissonance is a bitch. And so people are likely to believe the thing that feeds the beliefs they already have. And so if someone is inclined to believe that YouTube's policies aren't out to limit anyone's free thought at all, but just protect people, then them saying so and going on various shows and saying so, they're gonna buy that, especially if there's no evidence to the contrary, because everything is proprietary and their own policies are internal and there's nothing transparent. Now, if, for example, we're in this world that I'm talking about where there's, you know, hundreds of different sites distribute a particular piece of content or have the ability to distribute them, but obviously just a few are going to rise to the top because they have the best interfaces and stuff like that. But then one of them completely cuts off every Democrat.
Right.
Right. Or every significant Democrat, leaves all the ones that aren't having too much of an impact, but cuts off all the significant ones. Then it makes it really obvious that they have a bias against Democrats, and likewise in the other direction, likewise about a particular policy. When there's open competition and an open market, it makes it a lot harder to hide your biases and pretend as if they're not really there. And right. I would say it's honestly fine for websites, even the news for that matter, to have a bias if it's visible. Right. The biggest lie that the news or the technology sites kind of push is when there is claiming to be unbiased when they in fact are, because it's a disservice to everyone involved. If they could just lean into it and their users and the people who are considering whether or not to use them were aware of what their biases were, they would be able to, you know, vote with their money, vote with their wallets, go where they're being supported. And I think that would be a much more healthy ecosystem than one where we just have to kind of infer biases through no transparency whatsoever. Because you'd be able to see, like, even if it's not where they've cut off all Democrats, but say, for example, someone's message is really resonating on 99% of these, but one of them, it's just not there. Well, in that case, they're still on the site, but they're not very popular. Well, maybe that's because they've got their algorithms behind the scenes are, putting a foot on the scale kind of thing, sure. and downweighting that kind of stuff. And you can only see that if you're comparing A to B, if you're comparing how successful someone is on an open platform versus how they are on one that claims to you it isn't, it just reveals some of those things a lot more transparently.
And again, this is stuff that I worry about this stuff all the time. And
the future of the internet is scary if we don't fix this kind of stuff.
But, you know, my thought process, and I think we're probably on the same page on this. My thought is that if you have a site, an aggregator, that is open across the board, that would be the most popular site that people would tend to go to at that point. Whether it's got Alex Jones on there or
whoever. You know, I mean, network effect alone. Right. Network effect alone, generally, for the most part, people, even if they get enraged that someone that they don't like is on the same site that they're on, if it's otherwise a great site and has the largest audience, they're going right. to use it anyway. That's just, I mean, again, YouTube is proof of that. You know, I don't think
YouTube is proof.
I don't think that YouTube took down Alex Jones because they were losing business over it. It was an ideological decision. They didn't Absolutely. Like what he was saying. And a lot of it did, in fact, break their terms of service. So they had the right to do so. But it costs them money, I'm sure of it.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
No, I agree. So all that being said, you know, I'm the cybercrime guy, the cybersecurity guy. Yes, sir. One of the things that I was, this has been probably 3 years ago. There was a criminal website, criminal marketplace called Joker's Stash. All right. And the way that you had to access that website was going through blockchain DNS. And that was the first time that I had ever encountered that. And I thought that it was absolutely outstanding from a security point of view.
Mm-hmm,
I truly did. And
decentralized DNS, absolutely.
Right, yeah. Right. And since that point, I've had a lot of hope about Web3 and that this type of decentralized security solving mm-hmm. or potentially solving a lot of the identity problems that we have out mm-hmm. there, a lot exactly. of the cybersecurity issues, a lot of that threat landscape.
Honeypot issues.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So if you could talk to me about that a little bit, you know, especially like identity, if you think about cybercrime, and most cybercrime is financially slanted. Mm-hmm. If it's a financial cybercrime, there's always an element of identity theft that's involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you could talk to me a little bit about how Web3 could help to identify specific users so that we could potentially start to mitigate the identity theft problem that's out there.
Well, okay, let me get to identifying users. Sure. I'd say it helps in a handful of different ways. For one, the example I was talking about involved the idea of you being able to do direct commerce with your customers, right? In some cases, you'd say some people can watch ads, but if you want to pay for it, so just the ability to do micropayments alone. If you think about the fact that right now there are two markets of payments on the internet, anything over $1, you can use a credit card or a debit card for. If it's not worth over $1, the most you can get from it is a fraction of a penny, because that's the most that ads are going to be worth, right? And so there's this huge gap in between the fraction of a penny and a dollar it's where I would argue that the majority of content of the internet is actually worth, you know, like a play on YouTube is a couple of or an article is worth a couple of cents, a play on YouTube worth maybe a little bit more than that kind of thing. And there's no fiat mechanism for actually handling that. The cost of fraud and the cost of processing is just too high for banks to be able to do internet payments at such a low cost. So just doing micropayments alone helps solve some of that, because it was actually funny enough, I learned about this recently. The history of how we got to this model where everything is based on ads and private data, selling everyone, you know, selling your data, was literally the dot-com crash, because the early websites got great big batches of users and a whole lot of kind of user data and stuff like that, and just the geo data about what IPs are coming from where and stuff like that. And then when they started going out of business, they started, in order to get some value out of what they had left, they started selling that data to other people, and that created the data brokers, and that became the business model. When there was no other business model that you could use on the web, that was it. That's the default business model. And there's so much fraud involved. You've seen all the click farms and stuff like that are just faking users and stuff like that, that the value of that is going lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. So being able to, but there's so much commercial value going across the internet, we need to have some business model. It can't all be free. It won't work. You will lose the value of the content being created on the internet will go through the floor if suddenly no one can commercialize the content that they're putting onto it.
Right.
And there just naturally is a whole bunch. When you have a market of 6 billion potential people to reach and you have something valuable you want to share, it's useful to share it and put it out in the world. So right now, without the business model of direct payments, we depend entirely on ads and spying on us, right? And because spying on us requires that we're not running ad blockers and various other things within our web browser to kind of anonymize our visits and stuff like that. And now they've started pushing back. I don't know if you've ever noticed, I on one of my YouTube accounts I have red, and another one I don't. When I happen to watch a YouTube ad or go to a YouTube when I'm logged into the other one, it's been warning me for the past like 2 weeks now, it's against our terms of service for you to run an ad blocker. And I was like, right. I was stunned, honestly, that they started doing this. So they push back as hard as they can because it's all they got. It's literally all they got. But the side effect of that is that every one of those companies becomes this giant honeypot of personal information. And so the value of hacking one of those companies is incredibly high, obviously way more than just their employees or any other kind of, you know, the user data they really need, but also this other data that they collect as a happenstance and that they have started to intentionally try to collect because it's how they make all their money. So I would argue that that's one of the most direct things. Just, you know, micropayments itself can help solve that because it takes away the need for the honeypot, for them to create these honeypots. Gotcha. But then beyond that, just the fact that in order for you to use a credit card over the internet required HTTPS to be invented in the first place. But then once you share that information, the information that you're sharing, because the payment system, the basic, the banking payment system, it's been described in the cryptocurrency industry, they call it a pull system, where Bitcoin is a push system. With Bitcoin, you're the person who I want to send to, so I need your information and I push money to you.
Right.
With credit cards or debit cards or anything else, if you're the person that needs the money, I need to give you a bunch of information and then you pull that money from me. But that also means if you leaked that information, if you didn't protect it perfectly well, or if someone caught that information on the way, just between the credit card number and the expiration date and the billing address and sometimes my name, that's enough money for anyone to spend any amount that they want, right? And so just sharing credit card information over the internet is enough to be able to steal massive amounts from you just because of the nature of it. If someone right. saw my Bitcoin transaction coming across, they couldn't use any information from it to steal more money from me. Every signature, every new signature on a new transaction is uniquely created for the sake of that transaction. And if you understand public key cryptography, you understand no matter how many times you see that, it's incredibly hard to reverse engineer that and be able to create the private key necessary to sign another transaction. So it's inherently right. more secure on that front. As far as identity, identity is a really interesting thing because it's like most of the stuff that you put on a blockchain is public, and it's beneficial for that reason. It's what keeps Bitcoin honest. It's what makes us know that there's only so many Bitcoins out there. It's what, you know, how you know that your transaction got to where it was supposed to go, et cetera. It all needs to be public. But identity information shouldn't be, right? If all I'm trying to do is I'm trying to validate that I am the creator of something, I shouldn't need to share my identity with someone, or that I am the owner of an account. I shouldn't need to share all of my identifying information in order to do so. Unfortunately, a lot of laws essentially have gotten us to the point where there's so much know your customer required in so many different things that a whole lot of things that shouldn't really need to know all my personal information in order to process something have to, you know, just because of the government permission slips involved. That's unfortunate. There are better ways to do that. And you're kind of touching on one of them, where you could build an identity system where what you've got, a lot of people think that blockchain is anonymous. Some of them are, you know, ZK and stuff like that are, but really for the most part, Bitcoin and all the big ones are what's called pseudonymous. And what it means is you have an identity. It's just not yours.
Right.
It's a pseudonym for you. If you associate that pseudonym with yourself, it's like if you have an AKA that's running around and has its own identity, and then you create an association between you. Now you have been tied to that, and all of the things done by that identity and all the things done by yours are connected to each other. So if you're careful not to connect those two things, you can have two separate identities. You can have the identity of your blockchain public key signatures. Like, for example, all the pieces of content that you put out, you could sign them with your public key. And now you've created an identity that connects one to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, so that you can create a history that you can derive trust from. And sometimes you might want to attach your real identity, like if you're a public figure, or if you're like Taylor Swift putting songs out on the internet, so that people don't assume this is pirated, she might want to sign it and then attach that signature to her Twitter account somehow. And so now she's connected that pseudonymous identity with her real identity. If you choose not to, because honestly, privacy is normal. Privacy is in fact normal. And the Fourth Amendment does still matter whether some aspects of the government think it does or not. It does in fact matter. So I don't think there's any reason to claim that you need to always associate the pseudonymous identity that you have from a blockchain with your real identity. But a really useful way to do so is with something like a decentralized ID, or derived from a decentralized ID an actual namespace, you know, being able to use a .eth or something else like that, where the name records involved are stored in a permanent blockchain so that you can, so that your computer can negotiate all that and figure out exactly where to go to get to the thing itself. And then the way names actually work is they need to be registered to a real person, you know, on Namecheap or, you know, GoDaddy or something like that. The way these ones work is that they just need to be attached to a pseudonymous identity and they need to be paid for. If that pseudonymous person decides to attach themselves to it, they can, and that might increase its value in some way. But if it's just going to expose information about them so that people can kind of come after them and harass them and stuff like that, they don't necessarily need to. So identity is a tough one. Fortunately, I think it's one of the first ones that's starting to become really standardized. There's something called the decentralized ID that is on the Web3 consortium track for standardization. And it basically just means any public key can become an identity that can be associated with whatever you want on many number of different blockchains. And there's kind of standardization wrapped around that so that it can be not an identity in the form of like login authorization. A lot of people conflate those kind of things. But it could be connected to that, that instead of going through a login authorization thing where you need to remember your username and your password, you just need to hold onto your keys and then sign something that validates that you're the holder of that keys. And then you get access to whatever account functionality that thing was supposed to give you access to. So I'd say there's a whole lot of different ways that it could really benefit us. Hopefully I covered a fair number of
them. You did. You absolutely did. And you know, like I said, I've got a lot of hope for that. I truly do.
Me too.
You know, I'm the guy that in cybersecurity these days, as we know, I used to be on the other side.
Yes, sir.
But now that I'm on the good guy's side, you know, I've got a lot of apathy that's going on because, you know, a lot of these companies and God bless them. I know that they need to make money or want to make money. But it seems to me that the promise of Web 3.0 and the potential of security, as you've outlined it there, that really has an effect that works or has the potential to work. Whereas
has the potential to. I haven't seen it deployed well enough yet. Right. I've been really disappointed at how slow this stuff has built itself out.
Well, and that's the next topic that I wanted to touch upon is when we expect to see some of this stuff actually taking place.
No
because
kidding.
So far.
That's a tough one. I would say, first of all, who's at fault for this, for why this has taken so long and why the promise has been so far from what's been delivered so far? And I would say largely two entities have been largely at fault for this. One, the US government has had the worst attitude about this. They spent way too long pretending like it was a non-thing that gave a lot of people the idea that, oh, well, they just don't understand it. They'll never come after it.
Right.
And that gave a lot of criminals, a lot of scammers, an open invitation for just go crazy. And then once they did start taking it seriously, they assumed it's all bank related and it's all security related, and thus securities related, and thus
they went from one extreme to the other.
Yes, very much so, very very much so. And so that has kind of, you know, entrepreneurialism is hard enough as it is. And so if you are trying to build a business or you have an idea for a business of how you could exploit this technology to do something really incredible for the world, and you want to build it in the US because you live in the US, but you look around and you go like, wow, like these LBRY guys, they definitely had some missteps, but they had earnest intention. They definitely were authentically trying to, you know, improve the internet. And then the SEC went after them with all they could and destroyed them, right? And that took, it was like 4 or 5 years after they came out. So if you're like, after we've gotten successful through all the hardships of entrepreneurialism, there's this risk that the government's going to come after us for no, you know, fraudulent intent on our behalf, just because we're bending rules that they really weren't clear about in the first place, that's a pretty crummy situation. And so you start looking at, well, should I start somewhere else or should I just wait? So there's been a whole lot of people waiting at the sidelines or thinking, Well, there's other ways to make money in this industry. I could just be a trader, learn trading patterns and just obsessively do that for a few years and make retirement money for myself. And a lot of people did that. A lot of the smartest people in the industry did exactly that. And then some of them moved elsewhere, moved to, you know, the second party involved, and this is partly why, is the VC community. And I'm probably not earning any friends with that.
Well, watch what you say, because, yeah, you don't want to piss them off.
Certainly. No, I don't. But at the same time, I want them to take some amount of responsibility for this, because we have been advised by a handful of them that the way to build anything is to sell tokens, is to pre-sell tokens and create a new protocol and da 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 da. It's the easiest way for them to make liquid gains many years before the SEC is going to come after anyone. The SEC never comes after investors because they're there to protect investors, right? So no one's going to go after the VCs, even if they're the ones kind of directing this whole thing. The VCs have always been like, you know, just start an entity offshore in the Cayman Islands or something like that, and then don't sell to non-accredited US investors, and you'll be fine. And it turns out that's probably not really true. You're probably not fine in the first place. But also, it encourages the reason that the web grew as well as it did and grew to the size that it did is you've got one protocol, or really a small handful of protocols, and a billion applications built on top of it. With the Web3 space, we've got now a few thousand different protocols and a few thousand applications running on top of them. There isn't a very large, it needs to be triangular. There needs to be more applications riding on top of fewer protocols because of what I was talking about earlier, where you want the network effect, but the network effect should be focused on the content itself, so that you put out one piece of content and a whole bunch of people get access to it. Right. But they get access to it through a whole bunch of different means, because each of those is going to be able to fit exactly what the specific needs of each kind of user is. So that's the kind of scalable model, where there's a bunch of applications built on top of a few protocols. But because the early investor community made a lot more money by convincing entrepreneurs to create a new protocol, even if they didn't necessarily need to create a new protocol, they could have just iterated on top of someone else's. The investor class made more money with a new protocol and a new token, that they got access to the tokens, and Susan went liquid. They could cash out, you know, maybe wait a little bit of time until it made the most money possible, and then cash out. And then the thing was kind of burned. So that happened a little bit too much for a little bit too long. And there hasn't been enough energy put into figuring out what the best business models for building competing applications on top of few protocols are. Right. Nor has there been enough effort around trying to standardize overlapping functionality. Like, there's one of the examples that I like to use is storage, because there's probably the most different competing protocols around decentralized storage. On the one end, you've got something called Arweave that does absolutely permanent storage. You pay a one-time fee and it will realistically be there for 200 years. If you really look at history, that means it'll be there forever, honestly, right, because the cost of storage is diminishing so fast that if you can pay for 200 years of storage, you're paying for forever. On the other side, you've got like IPFS and BitTorrent, where there's no guarantee of permanence at all. Filecoin kind of turns it into this contract thing, so it's more like AWS, where as long as you keep on paying for it, it'll continue to be there. And then there's a bunch of other, you know, ones in between those.
Right.
There is no... What we need is standards built on top of that. The reason email took off is we've got three or four different protocols that kind of do overlapping things, somewhat similar, but then the email standard, the concept of these very similar looking applications that behind the scenes supported all of those different protocols. No one adopted the protocols, they adopted the standard of email. And that was because someone figured out, let's put this wrapper around it that someone standardized and obscure the complexity of these protocols. That's, I think, what the next step that is needed for Web3 is someone to put a wrapper on top of, say, decentralized storage, where it disintermediates the concept, the specifics of each one, and just says token in exchange for storage. And then these are the different features you get by using, put the flag for Arweave, or put a flag for Filecoin, or put a flag for this one because of these different features and stuff like that, so that Web2 developers can actually build on top of it, and we can have an explosion of a bunch of different types of applications that can be the thing that really pulls in all the users, is the competitive layer of applications that are really trying to iterate on top of each other, rather than everyone reinventing the wheel again and again and again and again. And I think we're still stuck in the reinventing the wheel phase, and I think we're getting close to the standards phase.
Yeah, and I like that explanation. I truly do. I mean, I'm not big on VCs. I'm not. But the way that you explain that, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, VCs are looking to make their money back, and
It yeah. works for them. It worked well
come
for
up
them.
With a new protocol. Come up with some Absolutely. More tokens
exactly.
instead of. And I, you know, I'm not a. I respect Ethereum. I do. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of it, but I respect it. But
I have respect for the work that it's done and the accomplishments yeah. it's made. Yeah. I have worries about its architecture and its approach. I hope that they're wrong. I don't think that they are yet. So right. I don't know. I have a lot of friends that have built really incredibly cool things on top of it. Fortunately, some of the scaling solutions that have emerged means people aren't necessarily dependent entirely on the Ethereum, on how Ethereum works specifically. But time will tell on that one for sure.
Right. So at what point do we get to see, as you mentioned, the email example is an outstanding example. So at what point do we get that type of conformity to where we can actually get to Web 3.0 coming into practice? Is this
and users?
That,
yeah.
I mean, is this?
I would say pretty soon.
A few more years? Okay, so pretty soon.
I would say over the course of this next cycle. Historically, what we've seen, I've been in this since 2013, and there is a cyclical pattern to the financialization of the cryptocurrency industry that's mostly derived from the Bitcoin block halving schedule. That every 4 years, the emission halves itself, and so in order for the people that have invested all the money into building it to not lose their shirts and to keep on doing so, the value of each token needs to go up enough that it covers their costs. And so that it's a forcing mechanism to get it to go higher and higher. And then because it's the 800-pound gorilla, it pulls in most of the value. And then anyone that wants to kind of diversify once they've made some profits, or once they've been sold on Bitcoin and now they're extra sold on it because they made a bunch of money from it. Now they look, well, is there anything else out there? And I'll just warn your listeners. Yeah, there's a lot of it that's scams. So please be careful. Do your own research. There's a lot of stuff out there. I remember when I first had the idea for what I mentioned was called the Decentralized Library of Alexandria. Another name we had for it was MovieCoin. And I remember someone posted on like Bitcoin Talks or something, I had this great idea, it's called MovieCoin and the whole movie industry will adopt it. And I was asking him like, why would they? And he was like, just because it's called MovieCoin. So why would they?
Add dental coin
That's
too.
Dumb.
Let's not forget that.
Right. There's a whole bunch that, oh God, there's a whole bunch that what they're, it all they're innovating on is changing the name.
Right.
There's nothing technically different. There's nothing, anything. And so most of those are BS, plain and simple. Some of them, because a meme gets popular. Hey, memes have value. That is what it is. So that might be valuable just because it is. But so you get this extra value that flows into, or that's coming into Bitcoin and it's going up in value. And now everyone's got this extra profits and so they want to move it somewhere. And so they discover some new aspect of the rest of the industry. My very first cycle, it was ICOs. That was them thinking they were really being creative or like avoiding the term IPO by right. saying initial crypto offering. That was stupid in the first place, because almost all of those were in fact securities. So that was right. unfortunate. This most recent cycle, it was NFTs and DeFi, and they saw enormous value flow into them. And because of that value, it happened because in the previous bear cycle, they put a lot of energy into building the mechanism so that right. by the time there was extra money, the mechanisms worked well. And so now when someone wanted to figure out what to do with their extra Ethereum or extra Bitcoin, they could put it into this DeFi system and loan it to someone at a decently high rate and get that money back. Or if someone defaulted on it, they get the entire, you know, principal or whatever else kind of thing. So that was a system that worked really well because work went into it. This past, and so usually that's the cycle, is during a bear period, it's quieter, there isn't as much hype, people can focus on just building, and they build, and then the next hype cycle comes out and the fruits of their labor is now visible to everyone, and they can actually see and they can use these things. Right. And so we've actually been pretty convinced. We thought DPIN and the concept of applying these concepts to the way that the internet itself worked was going to be emergent 10 years ago, but too early. You know, what can you say? Right. At this point, though, I'd say there's two dozen or so protocols/tokens built around this DPIN concept in a variety of different ways. They do Internet of Things, like I said, video transcoding, storage. There's probably a few, but I'm most familiar with one that is trying to basically solve. They started as they were kind of decentralized Amazon Web Services, where you can just rent a computer to use it for your web server kind of thing. But they're basically just a decentralized market for compute. And so that compute could be more specific than just a CPU used for web serving. It could be a GPU used for AI training. And some of the most powerful GPUs for AI training are $10,000, $12,000, $20,000 GPUs that most people that just have a startup can't afford to buy that. And they don't need it full time for their startup. If they have an AI startup, they just want it for 100 hours or something like that. Right. So this is a decentralized marketplace for that. So that if anyone has extra capital, they can buy a whole bunch of GPUs and then they make them available at like a dollar an hour kind of thing. And a startup that wants to train a model can just rent it for the hours that they want, pay with cryptocurrency. It's nice, fast, and easy. And then that hardware can go on to the next user that needs it, that kind of thing. That one's called a cache. So I would say they are in a better, all of those kind of concepts are more usable now. There's a handful of different applications built on top of like Filecoin and Arweave that are like competitors to Dropbox, that are very much consumer oriented applications where the user has absolute control, whether it's private, whether it's public, how long it'll be there, etc. So there's real world applications that can be used by any number of people. There's a lot of kind of YouTube competitors, etc. There's now something built on Arweave called the Universal Data License, where it standardizes the concept that I was talking about when you put your content out there, you want to attach some terms to it. Well, they're actually attached on the atomic level. So the transaction where your file went into the network also has all those terms attached to it. So we're what, at 30, almost 35,000 or so with Bitcoin right now. We're kind of maybe at the beginning of the next bull run. We're probably going to see it over the course of the next year where maybe it tops out at 100 or 200 or something like that. And so a lot of people are going to have excess money that they're going to thinking, what else can I do with all this? And they're going to discover, oh, there's all these actually working applications that really do change the nature of all the things that I use kind of on a daily basis. And that's going to be a first, because before this point, it was all very, very subset of the industry, financialized type stuff where anything was ready to use. Now consumer applications are ready to use. I would say over the course of this next cycle, we're going to see adoption of those kind of things. And then really what we're going to realize is we've adopted Web3 without realizing it, because it shouldn't look too different from the web that we're used to right now. The only difference really should be that I have the ability to own and control my own private keys, so that any decisions anyone else makes can't take away my own autonomy and my own authority over my own stuff over the web. And as long as I can control my keys, that's the only real big difference. It should be just as easy to use, but give me complete control.
I like it. And I got to tell you, you have actually, I'm the eternal optimist, but I had been somewhat pessimistic. And just listening to you, to the way you've described, especially this last part, I mean, it really gets rid of a lot of the pessimism that I've had. I've been the guy that's like, well, you know, 10 or 15 years from now, we may see something, but no, it makes
I think it's going to be sooner than that.
You say. Truly does.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that.
Devin James, Web3 Working Group. I absolutely have loved talking with you.
Well, thank you. I have as well. Thank you so much, Brett.
If someone wants to reach out and contact you, how do they go about doing that?
They can find our organization at Web3WG. Pretty much on all the socials, web3wg.org. And I personally am almost only on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, at Devin.
Whatever it is this week.
Yeah, exactly. At Devin R. James.
Devin R. James. Devin James, thank you again for coming on the show. I'm going to close things out, if you don't mind.
Yes, sir.
All right. So
thank you.
This has been Devin James talking to us on the Brett Johnson Show. We're going to close things out. How do we do it? We do it the same way every single time. Stay safe. Stay secure, stay vigilant. More importantly, understand this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. I'm Brett Johnson. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time.